Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're going way back in time to the world of the patriarchs.
Ooh.
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all their families. We're going to do a deep dive into what archaeology can actually tell us
Okay.
about their lives and their world. And we've got some pretty interesting sources to work with for this one.
Oh, yeah.
We've got a lecture by Dr. Jeffrey Hunan, who's a bit of an expert on biblical archaeology.
Right.
We've got some pictures of artifacts and
right.
even descriptions from the Horn Archaeological Museum.
That's like having a mini museum right here with us.
Exactly. So get ready because we're going to tackle some really big questions.
Okay.
Like, did these guys actually really walk the earth?
Right.
Can we find the lost cities of Sodom and Gomorrah?
Ooh.
And what can a Bedouin tent tell us about all this?
That's the beauty of archaeology, isn't it? It helps us connect these ancient stories to the real world. You know, it turns names on a page into people who lived and breathed in a very specific time and place.
I love that. Speaking of specific places, let's start with the Cave of Machpelah. This is a site with some pretty interesting connections to the patriarchs. What makes this place so significant?
Well, the structure we see today was built by Herod the Great.
Oh, Herod.
And he wasn't exactly known for subtlety. Think massive stone walls and grand entrances. He really wanted to make a statement about this site.
He always did.
Both for religious reasons.
Sure.
And probably to, you know, get some political points.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
With the Jewish population.
Yeah.
But the cave itself is much older.
Oh, wow.
Going back to the time of the patriarchs.
So it's like different chapters of history layered right on top of each other.
It is.
So you have this grand structure built by Herod, and then underneath that, you've got this ancient cave where the patriarchs are said to be buried. It's a pretty powerful reminder of the depth of history in this region.
Yeah, it really is. And Herod intentionally incorporated architectural elements from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem into the Cave of Machpelah. It was a way of linking those two sacred spaces and reinforcing the significance of this site within Jewish tradition.
It's like he was saying, hey, this place is just as important as the Temple Mount.
Exactly. He was a master of symbolism and political maneuvering.
Yeah.
But let's shift our focus now to the journey of Abraham. We're talking about a huge journey.
Yeah.
From Ur in Mesopotamia up to Haran, then down the Fertile Crescent, and finally into Canaan.
Wow, that is some serious commitment. Makes you wonder what it would have been like to travel those distances back then.
Well, today there's actually a project called the Abraham Path.
Really?
Where people can retrace those ancient routes.
Oh, wow.
They're experiencing that same landscape, walking in the very footsteps of the patriarchs, so to speak.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
You can actually walk the same path that Abraham walked thousands of years ago. Yeah. We even have a picture here of an ancient well at their Sheba, and you can actually see how the stone is worn down from centuries of ropes pulling up water. It's like a physical reminder of all the people who've come before us.
Yeah, it really makes that history come alive.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to actually dating the events of the patriarchal period, things get a little tricky.
Okay, so what are the biggest challenges in pinpointing these events? What are archaeologists even looking for when they try to date something like Abraham's journey?
Well, imagine trying to find a specific grain of sand on a beach.
Oh, gosh.
We're dealing with a vast span of time, and the events of the patriarchs weren't exactly recorded with the precision we would expect today. We're essentially trying to figure out if these events fit better within the early Bronze Age or the Middle Bronze Age.
I see. So are there any clues that kind of point us in one direction or the other?
You've got scholars like John Bimson and K.A. Kitchen who argue pretty convincingly for the historicity of the patriarchs, pointing to evidence from ancient texts and customs. But then you have others like Tommy Thompson and John Van Cedars, who are more skeptical, questioning whether the stories align with what we know about the history and archaeology of the region.
So it's a real debate among experts. What's the main sticking point for archaeologists? Why is it so difficult to find concrete evidence for these events?
The biggest hurdle is that many of the cities and kings and events mentioned in Genesis aren't easily corroborated with other historical sources. It's like trying to piece together a puzzle with some of the pieces missing.
That makes sense. But even without grand monuments or inscriptions, is it still possible that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were real people who lived in this region?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we're talking about the history of a single family, not like a powerful dynasty. It's not surprising that their traces are faint. But there are some intriguing clues that suggest these stories might hold some historical weight. For instance, archaeologists have found seals bearing the name Jacob.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty compelling. And there's even an Israelite fort that could be named after Abraham.
Wait, there's a fort named after Abraham? That's amazing.
It is. And then there's the mention of a Philistine king named Abimelech, in Genesis. What's interesting is that Abimelech is a Semitic name, but the Philistines arrive much later. It's a chronological puzzle that archaeologists are still trying to unravel.
It's like a real-life archaeological mystery. It seems like there are these little hints and clues scattered throughout the region.
Exactly. And sometimes it's those seemingly small details that can lead to big discoveries. But let's shift gears now and talk about what daily life was like during the time of the patriarchs.
That's what I love about archaeology. It helps us imagine what it was actually like to live back then. It's not just about kings and battles, but also about ordinary people going about their lives.
And a great way to visualize that is by looking at a Bedouin tent.
Okay.
Luckily, the Horn Archaeological Museum has one on display. It's made of real goat hair.
Goat hair? Okay, why goat hair? That seems like a pretty specific material.
Well, it's incredibly practical. Goat hair swells up when it gets wet, which makes the tent waterproof. Pretty clever, right?
Yeah, it is clever. So essentially, the patriarchs were living in mobile, weatherproof homes, but I'm guessing their tents were a bit larger than the one in the museum.
Oh, absolutely. Their tents would have been much larger with separate compartments for different purposes, like cooking, sleeping, and even receiving guests.
Wow, so it was like a house on the move.
Exactly. And here's another interesting detail. Those stripes you often see on Bedouin tents.
Right.
They weren't just for decoration.
No.
They were like family crests, a way of signaling friend or foe to those approaching from a distance.
So it's a form of communication. Imagine relying on visual cues like that in a world without modern technology. What else does this tell us about their way of life?
It really highlights the importance of tribal identity and the potential dangers of that time. In a world without established borders or law enforcement, those visual cues would have been crucial for survival. They needed to know who they could trust and who might pose a threat.
It's fascinating to think about how something as simple as a tent design can reveal so much about a culture.
And it underscores how interconnected those aspects of life were, practicality, security, and social identity, all woven into the very fabric of their homes. What's even more fascinating is that some museum workers in the region still live in similar tents today.
Wow.
It shows how some practices can endure across millennia.
It's incredible to think that those ancient ways of life are still practiced today. It's like a direct link to the past.
Mm.
Now let's dive into some of the other objects from this period. What can they tell us about how people lived?
Well, the museum also had some pottery on display. It's all handmade. No potter's wheel yet.
Oh.
With these distinctive ledge handles that were typical of the early Bronze Age.
So if we were to find a piece of pottery with those ledge handles, we know it was from that era.
Exactly. It's like a fingerprint for that specific time period. They also have a basalt mortar and pestle, you know, those tools used for grinding grain. Simple practical tools that have been used for millennia.
It's amazing to think that the patriarchs would have used similar objects in their daily lives. It makes them seem so much more real. But speaking of connections, we can't forget about the mysterious figure of Melchizedek.
Ah, yes. The king priest of Salem, whom Abraham encounters. It's a brief but fascinating passage that has sparked a lot of debate and interpretation.
So what makes this encounter so intriguing? What are some of the big questions surrounding Melchizedek?
Well, for starters, some see this as a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ.
Oh, wow.
And then there's the question of where exactly Salem was.
Okay.
Many believe it was an early name for Jerusalem, which would make Melchizedek a kind of proto-king of the city.
That's fascinating. Are there any clues that support that idea that Salem was an early Jerusalem?
There's actually quite a bit of archaeological evidence pointing in that direction. Excavations in the Rephaim Valley have uncovered remains of a settlement dating back to the early and middle Bronze Age, right around the time of Abraham.
So we know people were living in that area during the time of Abraham. What other evidence do we have?
Well, there are these ancient execration texts,
Basically
curses written on pottery.
Curses?
Yeah, that mention Jerusalem by name.
Okay.
It's one of the earliest references to the city outside of the Bible.
So even a curse can be a valuable piece of historical evidence. But let's get back to Melchizedek. We know that he blessed Abraham and received a tithe from him. What's the significance of that?
It's a really powerful moment that foreshadows the development of the priesthood in later Israelite tradition.
Yeah.
It suggests that there was already a sense of religious authority and ritual practice in this early period.
It's like a glimpse into the very beginnings of a religious tradition that would have a profound impact on the world. But this meeting between Melchizedek and Abraham took place in the Vale of Shaver. Where was that exactly?
That's another point of debate. Some scholars believe it was the Kidron Valley, while others place it in the upper reaches of the Rephaim Valley.
Lots of valleys in this story.
Right. And what's interesting is that much later, Solomon built his royal gardens in the Kidron Valley. So there's this sense of continuity across time,
right.
These ancient landscapes being used and reused for different purposes throughout history.
It's all connected. And you know what? I'm starting to wonder if this meeting between Melchizedek and Abraham in this fertile valley might be more than just a random encounter.
Oh, absolutely. It could be interpreted as a subtle echo of Eden.
Oh.
A place of peace and abundance where humanity and the divine intersect. Mm. It's something worth pondering, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. It adds another layer of meaning to an already fascinating story. But now we have to talk about a story that's captured imaginations for centuries. The mystery of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yes, the lost cities of the plain. It's a story that continues to intrigue and fascinate us.
Right.
And there's some intriguing possibilities when it comes to their location.
So where do archaeologists think Sodom and Gomorrah might have been located?
On the eastern shore of the Dead Sea, there are five potential sites that have been excavated.
Okay.
Including Bab el-Dra, which some believe could be Sodom.
But haven't there been some challenges in dating those sites?
You're right. The dates don't always line up perfectly with the traditional timeline of the patriarchal period. And then there's a newer theory that places Sodom at a site called Tel Hammam further north.
But wouldn't that location be too far north for Abraham to have seen the destruction from Hebron, like it describes in Genesis?
That's the problem with that theory. The geography doesn't quite fit. So the search for Sodom and Gomorrah continues.
It sounds like we're getting closer to solving the mystery, though. What makes archaeologists so determined to find these cities?
Well, Sodom and Gomorrah have become almost synonymous with divine judgment and the consequences of sin. Finding them would be a huge discovery, not just for archaeology, but for our understanding of these ancient stories and their enduring power.
I can only imagine what it would be like to uncover the ruins of those cities. It would be like stepping back in time.
Yeah.
But let's move on to a story that's deeply ingrained in both history and faith. The Akedah, the binding of Isaac.
It's one of the most powerful and challenging stories in the Bible. And it raises some really profound questions about faith, obedience, and the very nature of God.
It's a story that resonates with so many people on a deep emotional level. And it's even more powerful when you consider that child sacrifice was a real practice in the ancient world.
Exactly.
This wasn't just a story. It reflected the reality of their culture.
Exactly. And it makes Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac all the more profound and disturbing. It's a test of faith that's almost impossible to comprehend.
And this dramatic event is said to have taken place on Mount Moriah, the same hill where the temple was later built.
Wow.
That's a powerful connection, linking this ancient story to one of the most sacred sites in Jewish tradition.
It is. And if you visit Jerusalem today, you can actually stand on the Haas Promenade and look out over the Temple Mount.
Oh, wow.
It's a visual reminder of the continuity of history, how these ancient stories are woven into the very landscape.
It's almost like you can feel the weight of history standing there. But now let's talk about the story of Joseph. Is there any archaeological evidence for his rise to power in Egypt?
Unfortunately, not much to go on. But there have been some interesting discoveries at Avaris.
Okay.
A site in the Nile Delta that could have been a significant location during Joseph's time.
Okay.
Archaeologists found a statue and burial monument.
Cool.
That could represent someone like him. But we need more evidence to confirm a direct connection.
It's like a tantalizing glimpse into a possible historical connection.
Oh.
But speaking of connections, let's not forget the story of Judah and Tamar from Genesis 38.
Oh, yeah.
It's a story that often gets overlooked, but it provides some really fascinating insights into social customs and even ancient identification practices. Remember that detail about Judah's staff and seal?
That's right.
Yeah.
Wait, so people actually used seals back then, like wax seals?
Yes. They were used to authenticate documents and to mark ownership.
Okay.
And archaeologists have found real seals dating back to the second millennium BC.
Wow.
Some even bearing the name Jacob.
It's incredible to think that we can hold these objects in our hands today, objects that were used by people who lived thousands of years ago. It's a powerful reminder that the past is never truly lost. It's just waiting to be discovered.
So true. But let's wrap up this part of our exploration by talking about the Israelites' migration to Egypt. They settled in the land of Goshen, right? What can you tell us about this region?
Goshen was a fertile region in the Nile Delta, ideal for raising livestock and crops. It would have been a welcome refuge for the Israelites, especially during a time of famine. And imagine this today. There are only two main branches of the Nile Delta, but back then there were seven.
Wow, that's hard to imagine. What a completely different landscape it must have been.
It is, and it shows how much the environment has changed over time. But unfortunately, this period of peace and prosperity wouldn't last forever. A new pharaoh came to power, and as you know, the oppression of the Israelites began setting the stage for the Exodus story.
That's a story for another time, perhaps. But for now, let's take a moment to reflect on what we've learned about this pivotal period in biblical history.
We've uncovered some amazing insights into the lives of the patriarchs, the challenges of dating these ancient events, and the ongoing search for archaeological evidence.
And what I find most fascinating is how archaeology can bring these stories to life, even if there are still mysteries to be solved. It's a reminder that the past is never truly past. It's just waiting to be discovered piece by piece.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
We're continuing our exploration of the patriarchs, and I'm really excited to delve deeper into their world. It's amazing how these ancient stories can come alive when we start looking at the physical objects.
It's true.
The everyday things that people used back then.
Yeah, sometimes we get so caught up in the grand narratives that we forget about the simple things.
Yeah.
And Dr. Houdon's lecture actually highlights some fascinating examples of pottery from the time of Abraham.
Yeah.
He talks about how all of the pottery was handmade. No fancy potter's wheels back then.
Oh, wow.
And he even points out these distinctive ledge handles that were typical of the early Bronze Age.
So if we stumbled upon a shard of pottery with one of those ledge handles, we'd know it was from that era. It's like having a little time machine in our hands.
Exactly. And it's those small details that help us paint a more complete picture of the past.
Yeah.
Dr. Rudin also describes a basalt mortar and pestle.
Okay.
You know, those tools used for grinding grain.
Right.
Simple, practical tools that have been used for millennia.
It's amazing how some things never change. It really makes you think about the connections we have to those who came before us, how we're all part of this long chain of human experience. And speaking of connections, I keep thinking about that Bedouin tent in the museum. It's such a powerful symbol of the patriarch's nomadic lifestyle.
It is.
Yeah.
It speaks to their adaptability, their resilience, and their ability to move with their flocks and herds across vast distances. And remember that detail about the stripes on the tent?
Yeah.
They weren't just decorative. They were like family crests, a way of communicating identity and allegiance in a world without modern technology.
I love that detail. It's so clever. It makes you wonder what other ways did they communicate in a world without cell phones and social media?
Well, they relied heavily on oral traditions, stories passed down from generation to generation. And they used visual cues like those stripes on the tent to signal their identity and their intentions.
It must have been a very different world, a world where communication was both essential and challenging. And speaking of challenges, let's talk about deciphering ancient languages and scripts. It must be like cracking a code, right?
It absolutely is. And sometimes the most unexpected discoveries can provide crucial clues. Remember those Egyptian execration texts we mentioned earlier?
Yes.
The ancient curses written on pottery.
Those were wild. It's hard to believe people actually wrote curses on pottery.
It might seem strange to us, but it was a way of invoking supernatural power, a way of expressing anger or seeking revenge. And what's remarkable is that some of those texts actually mention Jerusalem by name, providing us with one of the earliest references to the city outside of the Bible.
So even a curse can be a valuable piece of historical evidence. It goes to show that sometimes the most interesting discoveries come from the most unexpected places. But let's shift gears now and talk about the patriarch's relationship with Egypt.
It's a fascinating dynamic. Egypt was a major power player in the ancient world, exerting a profound influence on the surrounding regions, both politically and culturally. And the biblical narratives reflect that reality.
It's interesting to think about how these small nomadic groups interacted with this powerful empire. It must have been a bit intimidating, right?
It probably was. But it also presented opportunities for trade and cultural exchange. Dr. Houdon's lecture actually mentions a really intriguing piece of evidence, a tomb painting.
Okay.
From a site called Beni Hassan in Egypt.
Okay.
It depicts a group of Asiatics, possibly Canaanites or even early Israelites, arriving in Egypt with their livestock and goods.
It's like a snapshot of those ancient trade routes, the movement of people and ideas across vast distances. What a find.
It's a remarkable discovery that aligns perfectly with the biblical narrative, showing us how people moved and interacted across these vast distances. It really brings that world to life.
It does. And it reminds us that even in ancient times, the world was more interconnected than we might imagine. Now let's talk about one of the most enigmatic figures in the story of the patriarchs, Melchizedek.
Ah, yes. The king priest of Salem. His encounter with Abraham is so brief, yet it has sparked countless interpretations and theological debates over the centuries.
So what are some of the big questions surrounding this mysterious figure?
Well, there's the question of his identity. Some scholars see him as a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, a symbol of God's presence in the world, even before the coming of Jesus. And then there's the question of Salem, Was it an early name for Jerusalem? If so, that would make Melchizedek a kind of proto-king of the city.
That's fascinating. And remember that detail about Melchizedek blessing Abraham and receiving a tithe from him? It's almost like a foreshadowing of the priesthood.
It is. It suggests that there was already a sense of religious ritual and authority in this early period, and it hints at the development of the priesthood in later Israelite tradition. It's a small detail that opens up some really big questions about the evolution of religious beliefs and practices.
And when you consider the location of their meeting, that Vale of Sheva, it adds another layer of symbolism to the story.
Exactly. Whether it was the Kidron Valley or the upper reaches of the Rephaim Valley, those places were known for their fertility and abundance. It's almost like a subtle echo of Eden, a place of peace and reconciliation where humanity and the divine intersect.
It's amazing how these ancient stories can be interpreted on so many different levels. They're like layers of meaning waiting to be uncovered. But now we have to talk about a story that's both fascinating and horrifying, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
It's a story that has captured our imaginations for centuries, and it raises some profound questions about morality, justice, and the consequences of sin.
Those lost cities of the plain destroyed by fire and brimstone, they've become almost synonymous with divine judgment. It's a story that resonates on a deep emotional level.
It does. And it speaks to our fascination with the idea of lost civilizations and the enduring power of ancient myths. It's no wonder that archaeologists have been so determined to find these cities.
And have they? Have archaeologists uncovered any evidence of Sodom and Gomorrah?
There are some promising leads, particularly on the eastern shore of the Dead Sea. There are five potential sites in that area, including Bab Edra, which has been linked to Sodom by some scholars.
Mm-hmm.
But as we discussed earlier, there are still questions about the chronology of those sites, and the evidence isn't always clear-cut.
So the search continues. It seems like there's always another layer to uncover, another mystery to solve. But speaking of mysteries, the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, presents its own set of challenges.
It's a story that has been interpreted in countless ways, and it continues to provoke debate and discussion. It touches on some of the most fundamental questions of faith, obedience, and the very nature of God.
And it's important to remember that in the ancient world, child sacrifice was a real and horrific practice. This wasn't just a story. It was rooted in the cultural landscape of that time.
Exactly. And it makes Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac all the more perplexing and disturbing. What kind of God would demand such a thing? What does it say about faith and obedience? These are questions that people have been wrestling with for centuries.
And to think this dramatic event is said to have taken place on Mount Moriah, the very same hill where the temple was later built.
Right.
That's a powerful connection, linking this ancient story to one of the most sacred sites in Judaism.
It is, and it highlights how these ancient stories continue to shape our understanding of the world, how they're woven into the very fabric of our beliefs and traditions.
It's almost like those ancient events are still echoing through time, influencing the present in ways we may never fully understand. But let's shift gears again and talk about the story of Joseph. His journey is one of betrayal, forgiveness, and ultimately redemption.
And it's a story that highlights the complex relationship between the Israelites and Egypt. Joseph's rise to power in Egypt is a testament to his intelligence, his resilience, and perhaps even a bit of divine providence.
But is there any archaeological evidence to support his story?
Not a lot to go on, I'm afraid. But there have been some intriguing discoveries at Avaris, a site in the Nile Delta that was once a major Egyptian city. Archaeologists have found a statue and a burial monument that could potentially represent someone like Joseph. It's certainly suggestive, but more evidence is needed to confirm a direct connection.
It's like a tantalizing clue, a hint that there might be more to the story waiting to be discovered. And speaking of clues, let's not forget about the story of Judah and Tamar from Genesis 38. It's a story that often gets overlooked, but it provides some fascinating insights into the social customs and even the legal practices of that time. Remember that detail about Judah's staff and his seal?
Oh, yes. It highlights the importance of personal seals in that world. They were used to authenticate documents to mark ownership, even as a form of personal identification.
Wait, so people actually used seals back then, like wax seals?
Exactly. And archaeologists have found real seals dating back to the second millennium BC, some even bearing the name Jacob.
That's amazing. It's like having a direct connection to the past. But let's wrap up this part of our exploration by talking about the Israelites' migration to Egypt. They settled in the land of Goshen, right?
That's right. Goshen was a fertile region in the Nile Delta, ideal for raising livestock and crops. It would have been a welcome refuge for the Israelites, especially during a time of famine. And remember that detail about the Nile Delta. Today, there are only two main branches, but back then there were seven.
It's hard to imagine what that landscape must have looked like. It must have been a completely different world.
It was. And it shows how much the environment has changed over time. But sadly, this period of peace and prosperity wouldn't last forever. A new pharaoh came to power, one who didn't remember Joseph or the service he had rendered to Egypt.
And so began the oppression of the Israelites, a dark chapter that would ultimately lead to the Exodus. It's a reminder that even in a land of abundance, even in a place that seems like a safe haven, things can change, and sometimes those changes can be for the worse.
It's a reminder that history is never a simple story, that there are always twists and turns, and that even in the darkest of times, there's always the possibility of hope and redemption.
Well said. And it sets the stage for the next chapter in this epic saga, the Exodus. But for now, let's take a moment to appreciate the incredible insights we've gained into the world of the patriarchs. We've explored their nomadic lifestyle, their interactions with neighboring cultures, and the challenges of piecing together their story from the fragmented evidence that remains.
It's a reminder that history is not a static or finished product. It's an ongoing process of discovery and interpretation. And it's a process that can enrich our understanding of faith culture and the human experience itself. But, you know, there's one more fascinating aspect of this period that we haven't touched on yet, the role of women in patriarchal society.
Yes. Their stories are often woven into the larger narrative, sometimes hidden in plain sight, and they offer a unique perspective on the challenges and triumphs of life in those ancient times.
Absolutely. And their stories are just as important as those of the patriarchs themselves. They provide a more complete and nuanced understanding of the past. So let's dive into that next time, shall we?
I'm really looking forward to that. Stay tuned for part 3 of our deep dive into the patriarchs and archaeology, where we'll explore the fascinating and often overlooked stories of the women who shaped this pivotal period in history. Welcome back to the deep dive. We've been on quite a journey exploring the world of the patriarchs,
yeah.
Their travels, their challenges, and all the clues archaeology gives us about their lives. But now it's time to shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
And turn our attention to the women of this era.
Ooh, I get it.
Their stories are often interwoven with the larger narratives, and they offer a really unique perspective on life in those ancient times.
Absolutely. These women weren't just silent figures in the background. They were active participants.
Yeah.
Making choices and influencing events in really profound ways. Their stories are crucial.
Absolutely.
For a complete understanding of this period.
And we have to remember that these stories were written in a patriarchal society.
Yeah.
So women's voices aren't always front and center.
Right.
But if we read between the lines, we can uncover their strength.
Oh, yeah.
Their resilience.
Yeah.
And their ability to navigate a world that didn't always value their perspectives.
A great example is Sarah Abraham's wife. She's often portrayed as a woman of great faith, willing to follow her husband into the unknown, even when it meant leaving everything familiar behind.
And who could forget that moment when Sarah laughed at the idea of having a child in her old age?
Yeah.
It's such a human moment, you know? A mixture of disbelief and humor and even a bit of defiance. She wasn't afraid to question God's plan.
It's a reminder that these biblical figures were real people, grappling with real emotions and challenges. Sarah's story also highlights the complexities of motherhood in that era. Think about Hagar, Sarah's maidservant, who becomes a surrogate mother to Abraham's child.
That's a story that really resonates even today. It touches on those universal themes of power and jealousy and the deep longing for a child, especially in a society where fertility was so highly valued.
And it reminds us that these women were caught in a web of social and cultural expectations that often limited their choices and created really difficult situations.
It makes you wonder what Sarah and Hagar really thought and felt about their situation. What were their dreams, their fears? We can only imagine. But despite those constraints, women still found ways to assert their agency to make their voices heard. Take Rebecca, for instance, Isaac's wife. She's definitely a strong-willed woman who takes matters into her own hands.
She certainly does. Rebecca uses her cleverness and resourcefulness to secure the blessing for her son Jacob. She's definitely not a passive figure.
No, she wasn't. And that's such an important point. Women in those days weren't just powerless pawns. They were active agents in their own destinies, shaping the course of events in really significant ways.
Absolutely. And then you have Rachel Jacob's beloved wife, who endures years of infertility before finally giving birth to Joseph. It's a story that speaks to the deep longing for motherhood, the pain of loss, and the enduring power of love and hope.
It's a story that many can relate to even today. The challenges of infertility and the joys of parenthood are timeless. And we can't forget about Leah Rachel's sister. She's often overshadowed in the narrative, but her story is just as important.
It is. Leah yearns for love and recognition, and she endures many hardships. But she ultimately bears Jacob many children, ensuring the continuation of the family line. Her story reminds us that even the women who aren't always in the spotlight play vital roles in shaping the course of history.
It also reminds us that every life has value.
Right.
And every story deserves to be heard, even those that are often overlooked or forgotten. And then there's Tamar, Judah's daughter-in-law, whose story is one of the most complex and challenging in the entire Bible.
It's a story that forces us to confront some uncomfortable truths about the patriarchal society of that time.
Yeah.
And how women were often marginalized and exploited. But it's also a story of resilience, of a woman who refuses to be silenced or forgotten.
Tamar's story really challenges our assumptions.
It does.
And makes us think critically about those power dynamics. It's a story that raises a lot of questions about justice, morality, and the complexities of family relationships.
It definitely does. And what's striking is that these stories, while ancient, still resonate with us today. They speak to those universal human experiences of love, loss, betrayal, and resilience. They explore the complexities of family relationships and the challenges of finding our place in the world.
They also remind us that history isn't just about dates and battles.
Right.
It's about people's lives, their choices, their joys, and their struggles. And it's about how those experiences, big and small, shape the world around us.
Beautifully said. And by listening to these stories, especially those that are often marginalized or forgotten,
right,
we can gain a much richer and more nuanced understanding of our shared past.
I totally agree. It's been amazing diving deep into the world of the patriarchs with you. We've uncovered so much about their lives, their culture, and the challenges they faced. And we've seen how archaeology can help bring those ancient stories to life, even if there are still mysteries to be solved.
It's been a fascinating journey. And I think the biggest takeaway for me is that the past is never truly past.
Right.
It's alive and well, waiting to be rediscovered and reinterpreted for each new generation.
And who knows what amazing insights await us just beneath the surface.
Right.
To our listeners, keep exploring, delve deeper into these ancient stories, and ask your own questions. There's always something new to learn, and the past has so much to teach us about ourselves and the world we live in today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.